Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
All right, folks. Yes, it's that time again. It's time for What Doesn't Kill You? Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and this is the Heritage Radio Network. Today, it is my very great pleasure to introduce the eminent Dr. Walter Willett, who is a professor of epidemiology and nutrition at the Harvard School for Public Health. He is also a professor of medicine at the Harvard Medical School and the author of Eat, Drink, and Be Healthy, the Harvard Medical School Guide to Healthy Eating. He's also one of the principal investigators on the Nurses Health Study, one of the largest long-term studies to look at the effect of diet on health. Dr. Willett has published over 1,500 articles, primarily on lifestyle risk factors for heart disease and cancer, and has written the textbook Nutritional Epidemiology, published by Oxford University Press. Dr. Willett is the most cited nutritionist internationally and is among the five most cited persons in all fields of clinical science. He is a member of the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences and the recipient of many national and international awards for his research. He's here today to talk about the dairy industry, which has obviously been a focus of his probably over a long part of his career. And I am just thrilled to welcome him to the show. Dr. Willett, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you and good to be with you.
It's great to have you. So let's start with a little bit of a history of how we, as consumers, we were sort of encouraged to drink three glasses of milk a day, or, you know, milk became the superfood that so many of us, certainly baby boomers, grew up believing in. So I'm hoping you can sort of give people a thumbnail sketch of how that came about. It was sort of like a post-war, post-World War II phenomenon, was it not?
It was. Although, of course, dairy has been at the center of diets in Northern European cultures for hundreds of years. In fact, dairy production allowed people to live and survive in cold, harsh climates where they could make cheese over the winter and have a food supply and kill the animals during February and March when there wasn't much else to eat. So there's a deep culture survival aspect, as well as especially after World War II, a strong belief that inadequate protein was a major crisis in American diets.
Really? Is that right? And so didn't the USDA sort of team up and with other groups and start promoting dairy? Like, I'm thinking of the very many advertising campaigns that certainly I grew up with, and of course everybody is, you know, who's been alive since 2001 probably remembers the Got Milk campaign. I mean, there was a very large concerted effort to make dairy even more of a sort of aspect of a healthy diet than it had been over the course of the hundreds of years you have already cited. It was really kind of a marketing campaign that brought it along to be the big industry that it is now. Isn't that right?
That's true, and actually, dairy's been a big part of my life for a long time, since actually for generations. The Willetts were dairy farmers in Michigan, and I grew up in Wisconsin and in Michigan, and there it was not three servings a day, we had four servings a day of milk when I was growing up. There has been a combination of, I think, well-intended nutritional experts, but also very powerful economic forces. The dairy industry is very powerful, and these promotions have been heavily funded by the dairy industry, and the Department of Agriculture has been in a position of promoting dairy because part of their mission is to promote consumption of American farms.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there's an intertwining of industry, dairy industry, economic interest, and agricultural science, the government, that makes it pretty complicated.
It is pretty complicated. So can you talk about, for example, in the dietary guidelines that were promoted by the USDA, either through the food pyramid or the newer MyPlate schemata, it still maintains dairy in a major position of power, despite your research and other researchers that say that much dairy is maybe not so great for consumers.
Yep, definitely the role of dairy there has been real front and center in terms of dietary advice by the dietary guidelines, primarily from the Department of Agriculture, the pyramid, the MyPlate. First of all, it really is important to say that this is a complicated issue because dairy is not like soda, where there's mm-hmm. no nutritional value, only mm-hmm. harm. Dairy does have essential nutrients. Milk is designed to be the sole food of young mammals, including people, for their first months of their life. But, of course, it's not natural in most situations that mammals continue to consume milk throughout their life, and particularly in the large amounts that we're asked to do. So the evidence on dairy and health is actually complicated as well, not surprisingly, because dairy contains many essential nutrients, but it also contains a lot of growth factors that are, again, aimed at accelerating the growth of young mammals. And it's, whether that is necessary or even perhaps harmful, particularly for cancer risk throughout our life, has been a question. Now, there's some data to suggest that there are some harms of high mm-hmm. dairy consumption, but there are also some benefits. So finding the right role of dairy has been a challenge. I think, though, that putting all the evidence together, the large amounts, say three or more servings a day that are being promoted, do come with some actual hazards.
Would that be, excuse me, hazards, you mean like a high cholesterol intake or is it just the additives in milk, you know, in commercially produced milk that might have, say, the growth hormone, the what is it, the B? I'm blanking.
Bovine somatotropin, BST?
Yes, yes.
Right. Those do raise some concern, but actually those hormones are naturally present in milk and quite substantial amounts anyway. And there is concern because, particularly related to cancer risk, because cancer is basically a disease that's related to rapid multiplication of cells. Mm. And the likelihood of a mutation becoming multiplied is greater if you're making your cells multiply, if you're sort of accelerators to the floor in terms of making cells multiply. Mm-hmm. And so there is actually some evidence really coming from many different studies showing that that high dairy consumption is related to elevated risks of prostate cancer and quite possibly endometrial cancer.
Really?
Well,
wow.
On the other hand, there's some evidence also of a lower risk for colorectal cancer, but that's very likely coming from calcium, and you could likely get that same benefit from taking a calcium supplement that has no saturated fat, no cholesterol, and no calories, and costs a lot less.
Yeah. Well, there is that too, right? You know, you just spoke of some studies, and I wondered because, you know, I often look, as I have been instructed by Marion Nessel, I frequently check to see who funded studies for, you know, various things. And, you know, there is a huge amount of money has been invested by the dairy industry in promoting the health benefits of dairy consumption. So I was curious, you know, from a university standpoint, is it hard to find funding for studies that may not support that rosy view of cow's milk? And is it, for instance, difficult for researchers to publish if your views happen to differ from the, you know, what the dairy industry would like you to consider accepted wisdom?
I don't think that's been too much of a problem in this case.
In general,
funding by industry has been a complicated, difficult issue, but most of our work has been funded by studies that weren't specifically looking at dairy, but were looking more broadly mm-hmm. at diet and health outcomes. So that's been possible to do. I would also note that, of course, the primary justification for high dairy consumption has been that we need a lot of calcium to prevent fractures later in life in particular. And that evidence is really very weak. In fact, there's a lot of evidence to the contrary that we don't need all that calcium and that high dairy consumption prevents fractures. And there's been an enigma, a paradox for many decades. If you look around the world, it's actually the high dairy consuming countries are the countries that have the highest fracture rates, and the countries
really?
That consume almost no milk or little milk actually have low fracture rates, which there's multiple possible explanations for that, but it's very strong evidence that high dairy consumption is not necessary to have low fracture rates.
That's going to be a huge blow to the people I know who ingest vast amounts of at least calcium supplements in a hope that they will avoid fractures in their future.
Yes, it's pretty. Some modest supplements may be helpful for some people, but if they're not consuming any dairy at all. But the studies on calcium requirements that have been used in the United States are studies that actually last only 2 or 3 weeks, and that's a very short time compared to lifetime calcium supplement fracture risk. And in fact, without going into the details, those very short studies are likely to give you misleading and wrong answers. The World Health Organization has looked at this issue, and they've concluded that 500 milligrams of calcium a day is adequate intake, not the 1,200 milligrams that is said to be necessary in the United States.
And even more for women, right?
Intertwinings of economic interests that have influenced the recommendations in the United States, because if you say you need 1,200 milligrams, it's pretty hard to get there without quite a bit of dairy consumption.
Yeah.
But I think we actually don't need all that calcium. And these part of the evidence is these low rates of fractures in places that don't consume milk. But we've also, many people have looked at dairy consumption and fracture risk later in life. Some studies show a little bit of reduction, but other studies show an increase. And when you put them all together, there's basically no relationship between high dairy consumption and fracture risk in the overall evidence. We've also looked at this milk consumption during adolescence. And there, in particular, there's an emphasis you really need to have a lot of dairy and calcium to build up healthy bones and prevent fractures later in life. Well, it doesn't really work that way. Your bones are not like a big calcium bank that just stays with you for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. And we've actually seen that there is no benefit to high dairy consumption for fracture risk later in life. No necessity of high dairy consumption during adolescence. And in fact, the boys who had high dairy consumption actually had higher risk of fractures than the boys with lower dairy consumption.
How do you explain that?
Well, part of it is that dairy consumption, as I mentioned, is growth promoting.
Yeah.
And it does accelerate the growth of bones and makes like longer legs, longer bones in our legs makes us somewhat taller. And we know that being taller is a strong risk factor for fractures later in life. And so because of its growth promoting effect, milk does make people taller, and that it looks like that explains in part why at least may impact most of perhaps the excess risk for fractures later in life.
Uh-huh.
Also, we know that being tall is a risk factor for many cancers, and that's part of the evidence that does make us concerned about factors that accelerate growth and make people taller.
Fascinating. I'm telling you, Dr. Willett, you are just upending everything my pediatrician ever told me.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, when are they going to get the good news? I mean, I remember my daughter's pediatrician telling me when she was little, well, why isn't she drinking 3 glasses of milk a day? I'm like, because she doesn't like it.
Okay, well, you're doomed.
I know, and I felt
but
so
you're not
guilty.
Doomed, actually.
Yes, and she's very tall, by the way.
Interesting.
So she clearly didn't need the extra milk. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. Yes. That it's Now, that doesn't say milk should be zero, but these very high levels that have been pushed are almost for sure not necessary and probably come with some hazards.
Yeah, fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. So let's move on, because I wanted to ask you about the fact that, you know, because there's the whole industry of low-fat milk, 2% milk, 1% milk, skim milk, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, all of that really kind of came about because, as we discovered a year or so ago, and I know you would obviously remember this being at Harvard, that, I mean, I know you weren't then, but have this little scandal that broke last year, and then I guess it was in the 1950s, early 60s, there were researchers at Harvard who had accepted funding for studies from the sugar industry that would show that fat was the culprit in poor health outcomes and that sugar was essentially benign. And that thinking has undergone a sea change in the last year and a half, I would say. and now it's all about healthy fats. And I wondered how dairy fits into the sort of healthy fats profile.
Yes, that dairy is not in the healthy fat category because it is pretty high in saturated fat. It's about 60, 65% saturated fat. And if you compare dairy fat with plant oils like olive oil or canola or soybean oil, those plant oils definitely reduce your blood cholesterol and most specifically the bad form of cholesterol, LDL, compared to dairy fat. And we've looked at this also in our long-term studies where we're not just looking at cholesterol levels but looking at heart attacks and stroke, and that replacing dairy fat with these more unsaturated plant oils is clearly related to lower risk of heart attacks and strokes. So that dairy fat is definitely not an optimal fat for a diet. In fact, Finland, actually, in studies done in the 1950s and 1960s, had the highest rates of heart disease in the world, and they also had very high dairy consumption. Oh, they had about 18% or so of their calories from dairy fat. And because of the evidence, even back at that time, pointing to the harms of high dairy fat consumption and relative to the benefits of olive oil or other plant oils, Finland went on a national campaign to reduce dairy fat consumption. They encouraged their farmers to plant berries and basically canola oil, which comes from rapeseed, instead of growing cattle and producing milk. And their dairy fat intake went down about 83%, from about 18% down to less than 4% of calories. And their heart disease rates dramatically reduced, about 85% also. They did some other things. That wasn't the only change they made, but that reduction in dairy fat was by far the biggest change and had a dramatic impact.
Yeah, that's remarkable.
On cholesterol levels.
Yeah, well, of course, we would never have one of those campaigns, I guess, in this country, because then that would mean that the government was interfering in our...
The way we're set up to run, no.
Yeah, we don't want any of that nanny state stuff. That would be really bad.
We want to promote dairy fat consumption, and the Department of Agriculture has a whole branch that is out to promote cheese consumption.
Well, I was going to ask you about cheese, because...
With one side of their mouth, they're saying reduce saturated fat. The other side of their mouth, they're promoting cheese consumption.
Well, they also... because this is through the checkoff programs, right? This is through... right?
Right, that funds some of those promotion campaigns by the Department of Agriculture.
Yeah, yeah. The Got Milk campaign, for example, was from the Dairy Checkoff, and that means that for every, just for listeners who don't know what checkoff programs are, they exist throughout agriculture in terms of livestock anyway. I don't think they exist in any other forms of agriculture, but for the meat, poultry, pork, and dairy industries, sorry, Dr. Will, I'll just quickly explain this. A little bit of money is skimmed off of every pound or every quart or whatever pound of milk, and that goes into this marketing campaign that is administered by the USDA. And there's a lot of people in the agricultural communities who generally people who are sort of alternative type producers who really resent that. But anyway, we digress, but I just wanted to make sure that people understood that. So I wanted to talk, I'm going to digress again and ask you about the nurses study, because of course you have been, you know, seminal in that long-term study, which I think began in the 1970s, isn't that right?
Yes, 1976.
Right? And so what have you seen in terms of, or have you been able to isolate dairy consumption with health outcomes within that study, or is that too specific, you know, sort of a thread to follow?
No, we have looked at dairy consumption in relation to many different outcomes, heart disease, cancer. Mm-hmm. Again, it is a little bit complicated. What we see is that dairy consumption, if you just look at it sort of compared to everything else, it doesn't look like there's any benefit, major benefit, or any major harms. But if you mm-hmm. compare, say, protein coming from dairy versus protein coming from plant sources, such as nuts and legumes and soy products, definitely cardiovascular disease and total mortality is lower coming from when our protein comes from those plant sources compared to dairy sources. So it all depends on what you're comparing mm-hmm. dairy to. It looks, if you're comparing it to protein sources from beef, then dairy looks a little bit better, not very much, but better than beef, but not as good as plant-based protein sources.
And what about cheese, Dr. Willett? I'm a card-carrying cheeseaholic. I don't drink milk, but boy, do I like to eat cheese. So am I shortening my lifespan now?
Find cheeses you really like and have them in modest amounts.
I don't think that's possible.
You can constrain yourself, I'm sure, if you really have some good cheese and appreciate it with a little wine. Cheese is related to higher risks of major health outcomes if you compare it to plant sources, but it doesn't mean that we have to go to zero cheese consumption, and I think keeping it modest. But unfortunately, if you look at what Americans are eating now, mm-hmm. We are being fed vast amounts of cheese, basically, just like you yourself, milk consumption has gone down, but it's been replaced by cheese consumption.
Yeah. Well, that brings me to my next question, because I wanted to talk about, I think we all recognize that, for instance, the government has had a hand in encouraging fast food outlets to add more and more cheese. I'm thinking of like cheese stuffed pizza crust, cheese on practically every possible fast food combination that you can imagine. And that's because dairy is a gigantic industry in the United States, both for domestic consumption as well as for export. And so I was hoping you might be able to discuss a little bit the influence of the industry on government for subsidies for dairy and for marketing dairy abroad. Like, how much do you have a sense of how much the industry pressures the USDA and legislators to kind of push both marketing dairy abroad as well as pushing it onto consumers more than is necessarily good for them?
Well, clearly dairy is a very powerful lobbying influence, and they mainly work through Congress to pressure Department of Agriculture. Mm-hmm. And their influence is very disproportional to the population in the United States. And I just once had lunch with George McGovern, who you may remember. Massachusetts
course.
Was the only state that voted for him for president, and yeah. would have been a much better country if he had won. But
I campaigned for him as a teenager.
George McGovern explained to me that this is baked into the U.S. Constitution, but essentially because we have two senators from every state, and many sparsely populated states get just as many senators as California and New York.
Right.
And those many of those sparsely centered states have strong dairy interests, so they have a powerful influence way beyond the population that they represent. This is manifested in many ways, including price supports for dairy and many other forms of subsidies, of course, strong promotion of dairy products for export. So this is not necessarily good for health. That's not the motive. It's pure and simple economic mm-hmm. reasons. There's another aspect I think that's important to consider, and that's the environmental impacts of what we eat. Mm-hmm. And dairy production, and even somewhat more so beef production, have by far the biggest environmental footprints, especially greenhouse gas production, compared to other sources of protein or calories. And this, I think most people are aware now that greenhouse gas production and global warming is a huge threat to our children, our grandchildren, in terms of essentially the viability of life on Earth. And the impacts on health of dairy are not just the direct impacts on what we immediately put in our mouth, but also effects operating through environmental influences that in the long term, of course, do affect human health very importantly.
Oh, of course. I mean, we're looking at it right now in Cape Town, South Africa, which is due to run out of water in about 6 weeks, if I'm not mistaken. So there's a glowing example writ large of what's going to happen thanks to climate change. We're going to take a short break right now, and we'll be right back with Dr. Walter Willett, a professor of epidemiology at the Harvard School for Public Health, to talk more about dairy and its influence on how we live.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and on the line with me today is Dr. Walter Willett, a professor of epidemiology and medicine, excuse me, at both the Harvard School of Public Health and the Harvard School of Medicine. Dr. Willett, let's talk a little bit more about sort of our export business, because, I wrote a book about meat consumption, or I wrote a book about the meat industry. And in fact, that's how we met, because I was at the Readable Feast in Boston, because my book was in that thing. So anyway, but one of the things that was really fascinating about doing the research on this book is how people are around the world are adopting essentially a version of the American diet, much to their detriment in many ways, including the environmental impacts that you just described in the before the break. But, it's like the increasing consumption of meat is a symbol of middle-class advantage in developing countries. And it's an aspirational part of the diet. And so I'm wondering if dairy is filling a similar role in some countries. I know the Indian population tends to be big dairy consumers, but in Asia and Southeast Asia, they don't eat a lot of dairy food, but they are consuming a lot more meat. And I'm wondering if you have seen, in your work, an uptick in dairy consumption in countries like that and a commensurate level of some of the diseases that we face in this country because of our diet.
The consumption of dairy products is going up in many countries around the world, of course, being strongly promoted by our government and some other agencies as well. In Japan, actually, dairy consumption has gone up hugely. They were naturally not consuming dairy products much at all. But after World War II, there was a huge push to increase dairy consumption. And it's interesting that Japanese women are much, much taller than their parents are, almost surely a major part of that increase in height.
How interesting.
Is due to the large increase in dairy products. So if you walk in downtown Tokyo today, you'll see women, young women, almost 6 feet tall. It's amazing.
Wow.
And we know that those women will have high fracture rates. Interesting, they have not gained weight like in the United States, so their body mass index is actually on average going down because they're taller, but thin. And cancer rates are many cancers are skyrocketing. Colorectal cancer, breast cancer going way up. Many of the same cancers that we have. It's likely that dairy is fueling part of this. There's probably other factors going on as well, but their rates of disease are changing dramatically.
Fascinating.
They're still pretty healthy because they managed to stay lean for separate reasons, or deep cultural reasons, it seems. But their disease patterns are changing. And in China, where there was essentially zero dairy consumption until quite recently, consumption is going up a lot. Much of that is actually, some of it's produced by dairy cattle in China, and we're actually exporting alfalfa from California to China to feed their dairy cattle, but
yes,
a lot of their dairy is coming from New Zealand at this point in time and having big impacts on the environment in New Zealand, as I understand.
And yet, what's interesting is that in Europe and, say, even New Zealand, for example, because they have a lot of dairy there, it's a very popular food group. And I'm just curious why Europeans aren't dropping like flies from eating so much milk and butter and cream and cheese and, you know, you name it. Dairy seems to be somewhere in the mix there, in spite of the sort of emphasis on fruits and vegetables, which is also endemic to West, at least Western European diets, not so much in the British Isles, I think, but where vegetables are more readily available and fruits, it doesn't seem like they've gained all the weight that we have and, you know, have the same rates of cancers that we have. And I wondered what the explanation was for that.
Well, as you point out, there's lots of factors operating all at the same time, so
yeah,
some of these comparisons are hard to make. But it's quite clear that really dairy-centric food production system and diet, like Northern Europe had, I mentioned Finland already,
right,
but broadly across Northern Europe, that's clearly not an optimally healthy food system or diet compared to a Mediterranean-type diet, where there is some dairy, but it's a much less prominent part of the diet. And there's modest consumption of cheese and yogurt, but nothing like the large amounts of dairy in Northern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, as I mentioned, even going back to work in the 1960s, this was described by Ansel Keys and others that the major dairy producing areas had much higher rates of cardiovascular disease compared to Southern Europe. Even within France, one of my colleagues there, Serge Renault, did a study looking at French farmers in northern France, which was dairy-centric,
yeah,
compared to southern France, which was more Mediterranean, and the rates of heart attacks were four times higher in the dairy-centric farmers in northern France. Much of this is very directly related because dairy fat has been compared to, say, olive oil or more other unsaturated fats, and definitely there's reductions in cholesterol and LDL cholesterol with plant oils compared to dairy fat. And our long-term epidemiologic studies have shown the same thing when we're looking directly at cardiovascular disease.
Mm-hmm.
The good thing is that in Europe, many of the Northern European diets have changed their diets more in the direction of the Mediterranean cultures and reducing dairy fat intake, and heart disease rates have come down quite dramatically, Finland being the most dramatic example, where they had a really targeted program to reduce dairy fat.
Yeah, that was a fascinating anecdote, that particular thing. The French are quite vigilant about telling people what they should and shouldn't be eating, I think. And the Italians as well. I mean, that's where the whole slow food movement took, you know, root. So it just seems as if, you know, other, maybe it's because those nations are pretty much homogeneous. You know, it's easier to get those messages across. And so that actually makes me ask you my next question, which is about sort of how, you know, with the government and the industry working together to promote, you know, a lot of consumption of dairy products, how do consumers balance the marketing versus what is actually best for their health outcomes? Because, you know, as I described earlier, you know, my pediatrician, you know, 15 years ago was telling me my daughter should be drinking, you know, quarts of milk a day. And I suspect that that hasn't very largely changed. And I think, and even for adult women, for example, it's proposed that we should consume something like 1,700 milligrams of, you know, past a certain age, you know, to avoid osteoporosis. And you've just debunked the fact that the belief that calcium, a lot of calcium supplements will help you steer clear of fractures. So, you know, how do people find out about this? Like, where is the balance, the balancing information for consumers who want to be, you know, really truly informed?
Well, that's tough. They listen to your show, maybe, for one thing.
I hope
but,
so.
As you say, there's some very powerful forces. You have huge industry marketing, and now because of basically reductions in funding for schools very minimal nutrition education there, the material for teaching nutrition is mainly in many schools supplied by the American Dairy Association, and you can guess how dairy fits into their picture of recommendations.
Of course, yeah.
And you've got the Department of Agriculture promoting high cheese consumption, and you've got the dietary guidelines, which have been strongly influenced by putting the dairy people on the guidelines committee over the years, really keeping dairy at the center of recommendations. So it's, I think the poor consumer is not getting a balanced picture of the role of dairy. Consumers need to be pretty proactive. It's why partly one of the reasons why I wrote a book for the general public to really, when you mentioned Eat, Drink, and Be Healthy, lay out the evidence and give people the best available evidence about how dairy, among other things, fits into a healthy diet.
Yeah, yeah. So since we've had this discussion about that dairy is not the superfood that we, you know, many of us grew up thinking it was, what should we say to dairy farmers who are really on the ropes as it is in terms of being able to maintain their profession, whose, you know, the price of milk is so low that it's actually below the cost of raising, of, you know, milking? I mean, what's their future look like in your scenario? What do you think should happen with dairy farming?
Yeah, well, I'm pretty sympathetic with dairy farmers because I mentioned that. So for where our family came from.
Yeah.
It's not an easy life, and financially very stressful. I'm not sure that we need to immediately dramatically reduce dairy production in the United States. And part of the reason is that now, despite all that promotion of dairy, the average consumption in the United States is about 1.6 servings per day, not 3, which is being promoted. So I think we basically, going to 3 servings a day would mean we'd almost double dairy production in the United States, which would have dramatic environmental impacts and not be a good thing for health either. So we don't need a dramatic reduction in the United States, but I think we backing off consumption a little bit would be good for the environment and good for individuals as well. Mainly, we need to not be pushing it as far as we can. So, and many people are consuming way too much cheese. One thing you mentioned, cheese is everywhere. I would suggest whenever you see cheese, think nuts. Of course, there's some other options too, but virtually every salad has huge amounts of cheese if you buy it in a restaurant or store. You know, cheese does not need to be in salad, and there's many varieties of nuts that add flavor and texture and crunchiness and a good alternative instead of a huge amount of cheese on a sandwich. And it would be one thing if there was just a little slice of cheese, but man, there's often an inch of cheese on a sandwich.
Oh yeah.
That's just way too much. Think peanut butter and other nut butters, almond butter. There's lots of other options there. Instead of meatloaf, you can make nut loaves and just many, many other options. So they're much, much healthier. Nuts have positive health benefits.
Yeah.
So we need to help give people some options. And we're working with food services, with the Culinary Institute of America, trying to bring information to food services along with ways to incorporate healthier protein sources as options. Again, we don't need to eliminate dairy, but we do need to back off, particularly on this large amount of cheese that many people are consuming.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have another discussion at some future date on things like meat substitutes. I hope you'll come back for that, because I think that's a very fascinating trend that is really gaining steam now. And I see that, you know, the big players in the industry, Tyson, Cargill, are investing heavily in things like the Impossible Burger and other meat substitutes. And I think that's a very interesting trend that we should, you know, you of all people, you'll be the one who's really able to sort of parse that out and explain the benefits and the deficits of that change in our diet. And I hope it continues, even though I love to eat meat myself, as I love to eat cheese.
Pick a very good piece of meat and have it now and then.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, Dr. Willett, I have to wrap it up here, but I want to thank you so much. People can learn more about your work by going to the Harvard School of Public Health website. Is that right?
That's right.
And do you have a website of your own or a Twitter feed?
No, I don't get into that stuff.
Somehow I knew that. But I thank you so, so much for coming on the show and talking about this issue. This is part 4 of my series on dairy. I'm doing I don't know how many pieces I'm going to do, but you are the 4th one. And it's sort of like an all over the map look at the dairy industry as it exists today in the United States. And you've just given me a really important piece of that puzzle. So thank you so much for joining me today. And folks, we'll see you next week. Thanks so much for tuning in.
So long.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.